All right, so this will be a pretty introductory talk because we haven't gotten very far. And we'll make sure to ask lots of questions. There's practically no string theory in here, in spite of the topics of this workshop. So string theory, if you're familiar with particle physics, maybe it helps to ask. So first question I want to answer is who? So this work was done with Machiko Hatsuda and Yuten Wang. I don't think I can talk and write at the same time. That's what makes transparency easier. So, if you want numbers and things, there's basically three preprints. This one was the earliest one. It's called a new holographic limit of ADS5 across S5. So that did try to relate things to string theory, but we've sort of wandered off a little bit from there. So that didn't work out quite as well as we liked. And then there was another one, the different numbering system, 0709. Jeez, it's easier to write the titles than it is the numbers. 0.405. So this one was superconformal spaces and implications for superstrings. So this was sort of a superstring-inspired paper where we got a little bit further. But mostly I'm going to be concentrating on this most recent paper, which was like one of the last things on the archive last year. So this one is first quantize n equals 4 Yang Mills. So we didn't make too much pretense about knowing how this stuff relates to string theory. We're mostly just focusing on n equals 4 Yang Mills, and maybe if we understand it better later on, we can try to relate it to string theory. So the next question is why? And so there's various motivations for this thing. Of course, one thing is ADS-CFT. That's still pretty popular, and but in the first paper, we're trying to relate directly to the original understanding of ADS-CFT is ADS-5 plus S-5, all kind of thing, and you work with some coset space and stuff like that. That's actually pretty hard to work with because of all the nonlinearities and whatever. And so, we're taking a more general attitude now. Am I getting feedback? There's a really weird echo right here.
There's a right in the center of the room.
It's because it's like parabolic, all that kind of thing. It's all focusing on me. I always center them. So, we're taking a more general attitude. Maybe it's some kind of different Lagrangian for it on the world sheet or something like that. And so maybe we can find something that's actually easier to work with, you know. And maybe some dual formulation or something, I don't know. But that's one other thing to look at. And another thing, so that's be a more direct string thing. There's also maybe string-inspired kind of stuff. So, everything in string theory, you, of course, use first quantized approaches to do perturbation calculations. Even if you try to get them from string field theory in the end, you use conformal gauge and use conformal transformations and stuff. So you really use first quantized methods in string theory to make calculations easier. So that suggests, well, maybe if you have some first quantized methods for particle physics, that can make those calculations easier. And all this stuff with zero modes, stuff like that, might work out easier. When you do first quantized method, the loop integrals are sort of all automatically done. You already jump right into the Schwinger parameter integrals and things. And so that might be more efficient. And also, we want to do this kind of stuff off shell. A lot of the stuff in ADS CFT focuses on, because it's string theory, focuses on on-shell amplitudes. And then you have all these infrared divergences and stuff for n equals 4 Young Mills, so it might be more convenient to get stuff a little bit off shell, so you could maybe extend it to things other than just the usual scattering amplitude. You could consider things like confinement, maybe, and so on. And then another possible motivation is just if you want to do field theory, because after all, there is more to field theory than just Feynman diagrams. And particularly you want to do this in extended superspace, like n equals 4 superspace, which some people claim doesn't even exist. But well, there was a time I thought even n equals 2 superspace didn't exist, so I'm not so skeptical anymore. And then you could study things like second quantization and maybe understand things better from that point of view, power counting theorems, all that kind of stuff. So those are some of the basic motivations. But there's maybe other things you could be interested in. And so finally I come to the question, what is projective superspace anyway? So let me explain it in a way that makes it clear. Well, superspace people more or less know, so I'll talk mostly about what the word projective means. So here's the basic idea, and this will include other ideas of projective that you've seen, which I'll see as special cases. So let's start with some coordinates. Let me call them z bar, a prime, m. You have to watch out with these indices because the usual shortage of alphabets. So this is some rectangular matrix. So I started out with the bars of the unbarred ones, just notation, let me forget that. But the basic idea is this is going to be the index for the superconformal group. Let me not be picky about P's and S's. So I'll just look at UN Q2. And this will be some subgroup of that, which in this case, we'll look at U little n 2. So this is some rectangular matrix, and the idea of projective is that this is the global symmetry, and this is the local symmetry. So this is sort of a more convenient thing. Of course, it's very similar to coset spaces and stuff, but cosets usually have to start with a square, and then you find you have to use some big local group, which effectively just chops the thing down to a rectangle anyway before you can get to any place. So I'm just going to start out with this rectangle. And
is the number of fermions?
What?
First index is the number of fermions or the second index?
Well, there's all this notation, which you want to call bosons, which you call fermions, which is usually redundant because you always have a pair of the indices. But I'm going to think of the first one as bosonic and the second one as fermionic. That's only going to be relevant to things when I talk about grading, as you symmetrize, you anti-symmetrize and stuff. It's going to be pretty irrelevant at this point, but I'm going to get to orthosymplectic groups in a minute, and then it's going to be the notation is going to be a little more important. It's still just notation.
What do you mean by the statement that you think about the second part as fermionic?
It's just some sign conventions. It's totally meaningless. See, if you have two indices, the question whether you have two bosonic indices or two fermionic indices doesn't make a difference. It's still a boson. If you have one bosonic index, one fermionic index, it doesn't matter which is the boson, which is the fermion, you're still going to get a fermion. So that's sort of irrelevant. The only time it comes in is there's certain minus signs that come in, like we take super traces, which part gets the minus, so it changes it by an overall minus sign. And when you do anti-symmetrization, graded anti-symmetrization, is this part anti-symmetrized and that part symmetrized, or vice versa? So it changes convention, which side the square bracket goes on, or which side the parenthesis goes on. It's stupid stuff like that. You'll see in a minute when it's at this point it's so irrelevant, it's hardly worth discussing. But in a second I'll get to OSP, and then the signs will be more important. Okay. So this, it's clear what this index is supposed to be, because that's supposed to give you the whole superconformal group. And the generalizations to like three dimensions and six dimensions and stuff. We're just sticking to four dimensions now. Whereas this one is a little bit more ambiguous, and we'll have to see what's more convenient. And the argument is going to be that you want the best one is where the ranges of these indices is just half of those indices. But we'll see where that works in a second. So the basic idea of conformal is because of this local group, you can just factor out a square piece of the rectangle. You have some rectangle like this, and then you take a square down here, and that's gauged away. So you can basically just gauge this identity, and then the important stuff is up here. So just by definition, we can just write, let me just factor out this pure gauge piece. So this we can just gauge away by that, but let me just leave it there in general, because we may want to consider more general gauges for certain purposes. Okay, so here's the square piece. So this piece was just that. I just factored it out. But now this thing is the ratio. It's this thing divided by that thing. So that's why it's called projective. It's just because you can think of it some geometrical way, although I don't know how to draw the picture. The simpler cases, you can certainly draw pictures. You know, you look at like RP2 or something, or RP1. I guess for a blackboard, RP1 is really. And so then you're just scaling. You're scaling the whole thing by some factor, but it's a matrix factor. It's not just a number. But of course, the simpler factors would be where it's just numbers, where it's like RPN or CPN and stuff like that. So those are, there's a P in there, which means projective, and it's just this projective stuff. So this is just generalized, the matrices. So at this point, we're just doing a lot of stupid algebra. And now it turns out to be convenient to define another object, with the indices here are basically, well, the range of these indices is just really the complement of those. So this index is u n minus little n 2. And in some sense, this is kind of like the inverse of that, except of course it's not inverse because it's a rectangle, not a square. So we just impose this orthogonality condition. And then it's easy to solve this thing. So you've got the same W coordinates here, and then you have some other factor over here. So it's this W. These are going to be our coordinates that we're going to focus on. Those are going to be really our physical coordinates, the X's and stuff. Although this U and U bar are going to come in also. In some sense, we're thinking of them as gauge degrees of freedom. And they don't have any dynamics, but they can be useful things, like, for example, well, some special cases of this thing are a chiral superspace, which is little n of 0, and also, of course, anti-chiral superspace, which is a little n of big n. And so then, for example, for chiral superspace, W would have x and theta, but then theta bar, which is part of the full superspace, would be in one of these. Now I forget. I guess it's in U. A little n is 0, yeah. So then U would have theta bar in it. So basically between all these things, between the W and the U and the U bar, you have all your X's which are in W. You have all the thetas of the full superspace. And you have also some internal coordinates. And the number of internal coordinates will vary depending on the value of little n. But there's always going to be, so W will always have your four X's, half of the phase of the full superspace, and then some internal ones, which I'll call Y. And then U and U bar will have no X's, and will have the other two N thetas. And then it'll have some other weird garbage, which I'll say a little bit more about later. So this is just some definitions and stuff, and at this point it's a little bit mathematical. We know projective spaces are useful for various applications, but what has it got to do with, well, I'm doing it for space-time here. Why is that useful? So it turns out that this kind of way of doing things is actually the easiest way to write superconformal transformations, or for the case even of big N equals 0, even ordinary conformal transformations, this is the easiest way to understand it. So you're maybe more familiar with real and complex projective spaces. They're also quaternionic projective spaces. So quaternion projective space is one quaternion. We just can think of that as Minkowski space. Now, if you've seen this before, you might say, well, people usually say that that's, well, at least mathematicians say that that's the four sphere, just like they say CP1 is a two sphere. It's not really very precise notation, but you know mathematicians are never very precise. So really what it is, you should think of it as something which is scale equivalent to a sphere or flat space or stuff like that. So because you have this local invariance, you can, CP1, for example, could either be the sphere, it could be flat two-dimensional space, it could be, well, depending on the signature, it could be De Sitter space or hyperbolic plane or stuff like that. So that's going to be important because, of course, we're talking about superconformal theories. So specifically, we're most interested in N equals 4 Yang-Mills. So if we put N equals 4 Yang-Mills in an anti-De Sitter background or put it in a flat background, it's not going to make much difference because the Yang-Mills doesn't couple to the scale factor anyway. But it may have other conveniences and sort of algebraic things, and that stuff we'll look at. It'll also give us some freedom in how we choose gauges. So we'll just think of HB1 as Minkowski space, and then, well, superconformal transformations in general, okay, it comes out of here in the usual way that you've seen for, say, SL2 transformations on CP1, or just doing string theory, doing Möbius transformations on a world sheet. So what you do is you break up your element of the superconformal group. So I'm saying UM22, but of course you might as well just make it S because the determinant factor will just cancel out and stuff, but that works in the usual way. So just divide it up into these blocks. So I'm just dividing it up into these. I'm just dividing this up into unequal halves into these two things. And so this is square, and this is square, but these two off-diagonal ones might be rectangles. And then it's convenient also to consider the inverse, and I'll just use different letters. So if you want, you can write explicit expressions for these tilde things in terms of the untilde things, but that's a little bit messy, and we don't need it anyway. But thinking in terms of these two different ways and looking at the transformations of Z and Z bar, because both of them have W in there, and all you have to do is take ratios to see how W transforms, then you see that under a superconformal transformation, which, let's see, the way I've defined it, it either multiplies this Z bar from the right or multiplies Z. No, I did that backwards. I guess the way I've written it, no, the way I've written it is actually the opposite. Yeah, of course. I think it is right down there. So you either multiply this by G from the right or this by G inverse from the left because they're opposite transformation laws. Then you can either write the transformation law W prime is equal to 1 over WC plus D times WA plus B, or you can also write it as A tilde W plus B tilde 1 over C tilde W plus B tilde. If you plugged in the explicit expressions for these, you could do a lot of algebra to show that this is equal to that. But it's clear from the construction that there's two ways to write it. And of course, because we're dealing not with RPN or CPN, but something that has to do where these little blocks are just matrices now instead of a single number, the ordering is important. But the point is, this is very simple transformation. There's also the infinitesimal one, if you like. Delta W is alpha plus beta W plus W gamma plus, I don't want to use delta again, so W epsilon W. So it's just a very simple transformation. It's quadratic, but it's with matrices and stuff, so the ordering matters. So even for the case where big N is equal to 0, This is a simpler looking way to write finite infinitesimal transformations than the usual way you used to write conformal transformations. It's just you're using, you're writing X as a 2x2 matrix. So this is just another example of why spinner indices are useful even when you're not doing supersymmetry. And but it, of course it extends to supersymmetric case. So one reason why this is useful is, for example, if you want to do supersymmetric instantons, then you're looking at self-dual solutions. You can do a generalization of the ADE construction, ADHM construction, sorry. And then you're basically using the graded quaternionic projective space, whatever you want to call it. Oh, and in that case, this is chiral, because you're looking at concentrating on self-dual stuff. So this is just some very simple algebraic concepts that can be very useful. And very often things that make things simpler algebraically, there's some useful physical concept hidden in there somewhere. Any questions at this point? I think it's sort of simple concept. It's just sort of algebra. But it's nice the way the physics works out. Well, what is the physics? It's just the symmetry. The way you can represent symmetry in such a nice way. So other things you might want to do are things like construct superconformal invariants. So that's maybe useful. You might want to construct some amplitudes or something and show that it's manifestly superconformal invariant and how to construct things like this. So, and a lot of this stuff is very similar to things when you construct projective invariants CP1. Well, not really CP. It's effectively CP1. You're just looking at SP2 on the world sheet, and you want to look at SP2 invariants and stuff when you're writing amplitudes, and then similar kinds of stuff goes on here. So for example, and let me just use matrix notation now. If I pick two different z's, or two different values, two different points in superspace, and look at z1 bar times z2, well, this thing is not going to be zero. It would have been zero if one was equal to two. But now it's two different points, but I've contracted the indices for the global symmetry, so this is automatically superconformal invariant. It's just not invariant under local symmetries. But I can plug in now this expression for this solution of the constraints. So this thing is just equal to U1 bar times W1 minus W2 times U2. And it's the usual thing. You take differences of two coordinates, or you take differentials of two coordinates, then you get some simpler transformation of law of that involves only the C and D's and not the A's and the B's and stuff. And of course, among the superconformal symmetries, just this part, this is just like some translation variance. Although the way the symmetries are distributed can be a little bit funny. So what happens is basically the usual X translations are here, and any commuting translations are here, half of the supersymmetries. And the other half of the supersymmetries appear as rotations in beta or gamma. And then you get other things like the S supersymmetries, half of them are over here, and half of them are in there, stuff like that. So, of course, the translation invariance is automatically built in there, and the other stuff is a little less obvious because of the way U1 and U2 transform. So then, for example, you can consider things like the supertrace of, let me call this for shorthand, I'll just call this C12. Then you'll have something like Z12, Z32 inverse, Z34, Z14 inverse. So it's automatically superconformal invariant, but now it's locally invariant also because I've arranged these numbers just so the U's and U bars will all cancel out when I take a supertrace. So this is a really simple way to construct some superconformal invariants, at least the ones that people already knew about. Okay, so now let me say a little bit more about the details of where all the x's and thetas and stuff like that are, and some other funny things like.
How much theta plus plus being any of the changes that construction will impact the environment?
Yeah, you can certainly construct invariants that way.
But there's still was a question about size and type and function, so why do people know all?
Oh, what do you know? All of them. Yeah, I don't think all the invariants can be written in such simple form. I've had some invariants that I've looked at and had to construct. The only way I could construct them in some manifest form was to stick in some auxiliary parameters and integrate over and stuff like that. So it's not... So some invariants are really easy to construct, but other ones are sort of not so obvious. So I still don't know how to write the four-point amplitudes in equals Fourier angles and manifestly to the invariant form. It's probably just some very sneaky stuff going on, I don't know. There's also the fact that you remember that here I'm trying to do everything that's off-shell. And so when things are on-shell, then you have to use equations of motion all over the place on the external lines and to show stuff is superconformal. And so you'd really want to write something in some weird way, which you wouldn't have expected, where you find out it reduces to the usual thing just because of the equations of motion. So that has to be looked at in more detail. But the goal here is really to do the off-shell stuff. So super twisters is something a little bit similar to this, except it's sort of kind of trivial in that the rectangles are just won by something. But it's closely related, so it's useful when you stick this stuff on shell to relate it to the super twisters.
On shell, you don't want the super conformal there. I mean, off shell.
It's not really clear. I certainly want it. Whether I can get it is the part that's not clear.
Off-shell means m squared non-zero, or what does off-shell mean?
Yeah, right. Well, why? I mean, you can still, you can still write conformal transformations when you haven't applied the equations of motion. The question is, what, you know, how do you write that off-shell continuation and stuff? And there's, you have to watch out for gauge dependence, because it probably can only make stuff superconformal if it's gauge invariant. So if you want to talk about estimate matrices off-shell, you have to think of, well, you wouldn't even talk about estimate matrices, you talk about the effect of action or something like that, can you make that superconformal? So I don't know exactly how that would go. Well, certainly you want the classical part of the effective action, just the usual classical action, you want to be able to show superconformal variance there. How that extends for loop corrections and stuff, I don't know.
To divide by second, if you consider just super Grassmannian as some model of coset space, you divide U2, 2 over U2 cross U2.
I'm not doing coset spaces, because then you have to put in, it's just, when you do coset spaces, you make a square. And then you throw away the stuff you don't like, and it's kind of overkill, because the other stuff in the square is not useful. It really, you only need a rectangle, because you only need one side to have this range of indices. And then you have, and once you have that, then you have superconformal transformations. It's just like, here's a really extreme example. You can look at these coset constructions, and people will write spinners with coset constructions. So what is a spinner with a coset construction? Well, you have a group element, and it has two indices. So it's a group element, so it transforms, say, on the left and the right by Lorentz transformations. So it has one spinner index, because that's the representation, is for the left transformation, and another spinner is the right transformation. And then you make it a coset in such a way that you can kill everything in here except for a single column. So this is a really inefficient method to construct a spinner, trying to write a spinner in terms of a matrix and then chopping out of everything so it's just a column. So this approach is, instead, don't do that. Just start with a column, and then it's much faster. And so that's what we're basically doing here, except now it's not really just a single column, it's a rectangle, so we may have more than one column. So you can do the coset stuff, but from this point of view, all the other stuff always gets chucked away anyway. It doesn't seem to be good for anything. Whereas this projective thing seems to have just the right amount of stuff. It has it enough so that with these extra things that you're in the local gauge groups, you have enough to get the full larger superspace set of thetas. And you get a bunch of other things, which I'll say a little about later. But as far as I can tell, completing the whole thing to a square and putting in all this stuff doesn't seem to be very useful.
Is it partial gauge fixing?
You can think about it that way. Of course, you could also put, you can put in as much as you want. You can also always make something bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then throw it away. But what's the point? There's some point when there's no point in putting in more stuff. And I think already the coset construction, at least from this point of view, seems to be pointless because you're already throwing it, sticking in a lot of stuff. I mean, for example, what do you have in the full group space? You have coordinates for conformal boosts. I've never seen any application where coordinates for conformal boosts were useful for anything. So why stick them in the first place? So I just leave them out. And? What good is that statement? Yeah, but what can you actually construct in, say, just ordinary conformal theories by putting in coordinates for conformal boosts? What?
I just know one example. So in this, you know, T-duality of a start from this part, the different gauge fits. And it's also able to bring different gauge fits. So the gauge fits can get rid of conformal boosts, other gauge fits can get rid of the translation.
Well, we can talk about that later, but that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't think.
No.
All right. So, any other questions at this point? So it's a little bit abstract, at least not well explained at this point. So let me go into more details. So what are these W coordinates exactly? Okay, this is just a labeling. But again, just to show you where explicitly all of these things are. So, also to deduce some notation. So I'm dividing up, let's see the way I label it now. So A prime runs over little n, I guess. So this takes n values, this takes big N minus little n, and of course these are the usual Weyl spinner indices. And so I have internal coordinates, which I call y, and usual space-time coordinates, x, and then there's some thetas over here, and or theta bars, and the thetas are over here. So they fit into this nice rectangle, but in the most interesting case is when little n is equal to big N over 2. So this is the case we're going to focus on. And when I say projective, I'm mostly going to be interested in that case. Because the other ones, well, you have chiral and anti-chiral and stuff. We have only thetas, only theta bars, and no internal coordinates and so on. But this is going to be the interesting one because of these various different cases. This seems to be the only one that's going to be useful for n equals 4. And of course, it's also for n equals 2. I should emphasize that fact that people aren't familiar with that. There is, of course, an n equals 2 projective formalism. And, just about everything you like has been worked out in that case. So how to write all the various different multiplets and how to do supergraphs and things like that. So n equals 2 has pretty much been worked out in this formalism, although the notation of those papers wouldn't be familiar from what I'm saying. That's been done by people like Lindstrom and Rochek and their collaborators.
And in the case of big N equals 4 and little N equals 2, is this different from harmonic superspace?
In name, maybe. So there's some stuff been done. Okay, there's some stuff been done by some people who would call that harmonic, and then they would say it's only good for on shell, which is because I think when they say harmonic, they're implying something other in the interpretation, like the internal space is compact or something like that, in certain relations. And but their same assumptions would imply that for n equals big N equals 2, it's also only on shell, which is not true. So I'm not going to call it harmonic because you'll use harmonic for the term for something that's not projective. And projective, I think, is already a pretty good name because, you know, CPN and RPN and HPN and stuff like that is projective in the same sense. So I'll only use harmonic to refer to something that's not projective. And I may suggest some things that look like harmonic formalism, which is a bigger, It involves a larger number of internal coordinates than the projective one. At least for n equals 2, it does. But when people do the harmonic stuff, there's always some implied compactness of the internal space. Whereas doing the projective one, you really have to do the opposite. So there's some Wick rotation or I epsilon prescription or something like that going on. And so even though there's a straightforward derivation of one from the other, it's you can see that in order to do that, you have to, well, there's funny things going on. And for example, in the n equals 2 case, instead of thinking of the internal space as a sphere, you should think of it probably more as something like De Sitter space. And that has two boundaries, and then you can think of your fields living at the boundaries, which is just boundaries, just a one-dimensional internal space, and that's why for the n equals 2 projective space, there's only one internal coordinate instead of two. So there's something in that sense going on, and a lot of that is more technical details, so I can talk about that later, but let me just do these more general stuff first. But there is some difference in semantics that. Certainly when I say projective, I have this kind of thing, construction in mind, and I intend to use it for off-shell stuff, and it's worked successfully for n equals 2 for off-shell stuff. And this, the general spirit and harmonic thing is a bit different. The main difference is that there's more coordinates and the internal space is thought of as being compact.
I mean, of course, I didn't ask about the semantics. I mean, I would be interested whether what you're doing is gives a new point of view of what people have been doing previously, I mean, relating, using the harmonic superspace, say, for n equals 4.
I do have a new point of view, but I wasn't planning it on discussing it today, but I can still come back to that. Depends how interested people are. The point is, there's hardly been anything done on n equals 4 anyway, and I'm mostly concentrating on n equals 4. So I don't really talk about n equals 4 harmonic superspace, because for all intents and purposes, it doesn't exist, because things haven't been done. People look at stuff on shell. But if you're going to stay on shell, you might as well use super twisters. There's no point even talking about this space. The whole point of talking about this space is supposed to be off shell. There's a little more to it. I'm oversimplifying a little bit. But certainly, the case where it's clearest what the difference is if you talk about n equals 2. But since I'm concentrating n equals 4, I wasn't planning on talking about it. We can talk about that later, either privately or if people are interested. Okay, so what's so important about having this case, other than the fact this is a square and squares are nicer than rectangles and stuff? Well, it's nicer for various reasons. Like, you can't take the superdeterminant of a rectangle, you can't take the superdeterminant of a square. So there's simple algebraic things like that. But there's something that's maybe more important, which is in defining reality conditions. So, for example, chiral superspace, there's no reality condition. A chiral superfield is not real. You have thetas and not theta bars. How could it possibly be real? That makes it really hard to talk about chiral superspace for constructing actions, because generally, you also have to talk about anti-chiral superfields. And then you have chiral and you have anti-chiral, well, you're back to the full superspace. But the idea here is that by making this square, we can have this funny kind of reality condition that relates the thetas and the theta bars, even though these theta bars aren't the complex kinds of those thetas, because the range of these indices is actually complementary, and it's not the same values. But you can define a kind of reality condition, and you can talk about real superfields, and reality is very important, for example, if we want to talk about gauge fields. How can you talk about a gauge field if the gauge field isn't real? So, now, where does that reality condition come from? Well, it just comes straight from this group property. Namely, but this is the reason why it comes out a bit funny, because it's sort of pseudo-reality condition, if you want to call it that. So this is the, so you have un 2 comma 2, and there's, it's not just the identity, and mostly because of the 2 comma 2, that's part of the funniness. The other part of the funniness is the way we're doing ratios and things to define W, so that's going to make things a little bit funny. And so this upsilon thing, that's just your metric for this unitary group, and it's, of course, Hermitian, and it squares to 1. And I can write down an explicit expression. Let me not be too detailed. But let me not be too detailed about what I mean by these indices. But basically, there's something like this. And all the rest of this stuff is zero. And this matrix C is I minus I. So it's nothing too funny, but so what is the reality condition? Well, it's not, okay, this is the reality condition. Yeah. So it's a definition of, if you like, charge conjugation. It's the charge conjugation that corresponds to this metric. So that's very straightforward to work out. You define a charge conjugation that acts on Z bar by just defining this to be equal to Z dagger epsilon. So because of the group property, this definition preserves the global transformations, even though it doesn't preserve the local transformations. But we don't care about the local transformations because in the end, we're only interested in how this thing acts on W, which doesn't transform into local transformations anyway. So this means that CZ bar prime is equal to CZ bar G, just in the same way as Z bar prime is equal to Z bar G, and that's because Z prime, the inverse C, and because of that condition. So in the end, what we really want is charge conjugation on W. In fact, more specifically, we want the charge conjugation on W and the Hermitian conjugate of that. And again, I won't write out too many indices, but basically, there's a minus Y inverse here, and an I Y inverse theta here, and a minus I theta bar Y inverse. And there's also some C stuck in there. I think I'll ignore that. And that's X minus theta bar Y inverse theta. So for the case where, well, maybe there's not a convenient case. Okay, so anyway, this is the charge conjugation thing, and now you want to define charge conjugation on a field. So a standard defining example, let me define this inner product, which is basically just how to integrate things. So we integrate over all the W coordinates. And we want to get some kind of Hermitian action, say, for example. So I'll have to define some of these things. So I want to define this thing in such a way that this is a real object. And A and B are fields which transform such that dW prime, A prime of W prime squared, is equal to dW A of W squared. So they're densities of weight 1/2, say, just because then I can integrate them. This turns out to be a relevant example for the case of the scalar multiplet for n equals 2, which I won't go into any detail about. So to do that, so if you're using this property, which is essentially a definition of the weights, and using the fact we want this reality condition to be satisfied and using the definition of the charge conjugation stuff, then we find that charge conjugation acting on the field must be the determinant of Y to the minus super trace of the identity. Okay, I've defined super trace of identity in such a way that this is n over 2 minus 2 times A of CW Hermitian conjugate. So A is the function of CW, Hermitian conjugate is the whole thing, and that's why CW only appears as Hermitian conjugate. And so this is how charge conjugation is defined. So it turns out for N equals 2, you're not going to be able to impose reality on these fields because they're pseudo-real representations. But for N equals 4, this is the kind of thing you'd like to do. Okay, so far, all I've discussed basically is superconformal symmetry. And so this stuff all goes through straight for the case where we know how to do things, which is n equals 2, and you can check superconformal invariance is very easy to see and stuff. And so this is the kind of stuff we'd like to generalize to n equals 4. But it turns out, well, I don't know. It's actually more than just the fact that it's n equals 4. We really don't know how to do first quantized computations, even for n equals 2. So even though this projective stuff is useful for describing the superconformal invariance, I'm going to now switch to, well, it's not really a different space. It's more or less the same space, except we're not talking about the superconformal transformations. So let me instead look at a coset. So again, let me start with being a bit general. So now we're going to restrict ourselves to just looking at these super ADS subset of the superconformal transformations. And it's easy to check, just draw the squares and stuff, to see that after you do this cosetting stuff, the coordinates that are left over are just the same set of coordinates W that we talked about earlier, except now we're just looking at the transformation under this subgroup. But it's the same set of coordinates. So the idea is using OSP is supposed to make some things simpler for first quantization. Well, it's pretty clear you weren't going to be able to push superconformal invariance all the way through the first quantization, because we know already from second quantization that there aren't any conformal gauges for a gauge field. Why does that sound unfamiliar? Okay, talking about a vector gauge field in four dimensions, and the point is you certainly want Lorentz covariant gauge fixing, so you want to end a term like d dot a squared. But there's no way that d dot a is going to be conformally covariant under the same conformal transformations as the curl of a, because effectively one way of taking the curl of a is you're treating a like it should be like a one form, and taking divergence, you're effectively treating it as a three form. And of course, because those are different, one's a one form, one's a three form, they should have different conformal weights. And so there's no transformation where you're going to get both of those terms to transform in so that it'll be invariant under conformal transformations in any number of dimensions. So gauge fixing is already going to break conformal invariance. So we're trying to get rid of a smaller symmetry. And now you might say, well, why am I doing ADS? Why don't I do just super Poincaré or something like that? So you can do something that's a little bit closer to super Poincaré, which is you can take a contraction of this thing. So let me call this I OSP N2, OSP N minus N2. So this basically means it's just these things and then plus translations in the coordinates. So that isn't actually super Poincaré, but it's an interesting combination of things. So it's like I told you, the translations in W give you half the supersymmetries, give you all the usual X translations, give you some of the internal symmetry, and then you have these two OSP things, which are going to be useful for reasons I'll get to in a little while. How long is this talk? I don't know. I can always squeeze it in by a conformal transformation. Okay, so let me go. I don't know. I don't know if people are interested. Am I spending too much time on algebra and people want to see some more? But I'm building up to
some examples would be nice.
Well, the example, yeah, but then the examples are all much more technical. Which point do you want to see an example of? I mean, to give an example of the previous stuff, I'd have to do like n equals 2 projective superspace. That would already take another hour. So at this point, I've just discussed symmetry. It's all just group theory. So it shouldn't be, well, okay, so that's how it comes out. But more interesting things will come out when I start talking about explicit N equals 4 superangles, fields, and stuff like that.
N equals 4 would be a good example.
Okay, so that I'm building up to. At this point, it's just group theories. I'm trying to give a motivation. Oh, yeah, the group theory is pretty. Maybe this stuff will work out right. And then I'm starting to get a little bit less pretty and trying to say, well, you can't be perfect. So,
question is this just nice, or can you actually do something new with this experiment that you couldn't do otherwise?
Well, I would say yes, we just haven't done it yet. But, I mean, the goal is maybe sort of a difficult one. I want to write down superangles N equals 4 superspace. I want to write first quantization of these rules. You can derive all these results that, you know, Byrne and Kosov and all those guys have done by all these horrible unitarity S matrix kind of methods, and just write down diagrams and calculate it in some simple way. And that's the stuff that this is moving towards, but it probably... Yeah, right, looking for that also. So I'll say some little things about that, but at this point we haven't gotten very far. It's just little hints that things seem to be looking right and stuff like that.
Do you think in this way you can actually get an N equal 4 off-shared superspace with the harmonic people couldn't do?
Yeah, well, part of the problem is really it's not only even conceptual. This has to do with this thing about harmonic people, like I said, always think of the internal space as a compact space. And that's not going to work here. But you could do N equals 2 projective space, and the internal space wasn't. I mean, the way the projective people say, oh, it's just a compact space, you just have singularities. But I think that's not a really good way to think about it, because if there are always singularities at zero and always singularities at infinity, you should just chop out zero and infinity from your space, and you don't have a sphere anymore, you've got a cylinder or something, or maybe anti-de Sitter, whatever. And so. And that was always killing them because they said, oh, it's compact, and this implies this, and they always got on shell immediately. And you can see the same thing, but you can see the same thing would happen for N equals 2. If you assumed it was compact, you right away wind up on shell. So...
Yes. You think you can do off shell, which they couldn't.
Yeah. At least so far, the problems that we've run into aren't the same kind of problems they run into. It just looks more like technical problems at this point.
I think you can write down the interacting algebra.
Interacting algebra of what?
Say the PSU 2,2/4. Can you find some nonlinear realization of the algebra?
Well, it's only a little bit nonlinear. I just erased the transformations, you know. But even
it would be even better. But I mean, just you know, can you find the interacting algebra even?
Well, we'd hope the interacting algebra is the same as the free one. How do you know? Have you worked out this superspace yet? I mean, why does it have to be different? You know, a lot of times interacting things, they become complicated in your algebra because you fixed a Vesemino gauge, eliminated auxiliary fields, and so on and so on. For example, you do supersymmetry in superspace. Does that become nonlinear interactions? No. But if you start fixing gauges, you start limiting auxiliary fields, then it starts becoming, then you see interaction terms. So that isn't something you want to look for, it's something you want to avoid. Certainly Yang, take for example something simple, just the ordinary conformal transformations on the Yang-Mills actions. Do those get interacting contributions? No, it's just conformal transformation, the usual free conformal transformation. So why should...
If you could do the interacting algebra, you could prove integrability of N equals 4, because then, I mean, the spectral problem is part of this algebra, so you would be able to find the spin chain, prove everything.
I find it hard to believe it's that easy. But certainly, we know how to write actions where conformal invariance has no interaction terms. You know how to write actions. Well, maybe you're not talking about the action, or you're talking about something else.
Algebra. I mean, that's a PSU 2,2/4 algebra. And
it's just the usual algebra. It's the one.
It's in a nonlinear fashion on the Yang-Mills fields, and nobody knows how to really represent
it. It's not nonlinear in the fields. That's certainly not true. Look, just think of ordinary conformal invariance in ordinary Yang-Mills. That's not nonlinear in the fields. And if you do superspace, the supersymmetry transformations are also nonlinear. So by the completion, you don't expect superconformal transformations to be nonlinear in the fields either. It's just because you picked a gauge or you've eliminated auxiliary fields, et cetera, et cetera. That's really the whole point of superspace, is that things are, symmetry should be manifest. They shouldn't be nonlinear in the fields. Okay, so anyway, this group is still a subgroup of the superconformal group, but just a little bit funny one, because half of the supersymmetries you have, the other half of the supersymmetries you don't have like that. You have the other half of the supersymmetries are added to half of the S supersymmetries. So it's a little bit of a funny symmetry group, but it's not that funny. You have the usual Poincaré. You have the usual Poincaré, you just don't have the usual super Poincaré. Okay, so now something really nice happens when you start looking at this space instead of looking at the full superconformal thing, which is the equations of motion get a lot simpler. Because when you have equations of motion and you want manifest conformal variance, well, if you do conformal transformations on equations of motion, you get other equations of motion. And there's sort of, the relation is sort of looks kind of trivial in the second quantized point of view, but from first quantized point of view, you get all these different equations and they get to be a mess. Well, let me be a little bit more explicit. So let me compare the equation of motion in the superconformal case to the super ADS case, or we can do this contraction, but just to make things a little bit simpler, let me just do this thing. So in the superconformal case, you have some generators. So the generators of superconformal are called G hat. G hat MN. And then what do the equations of motion look like? They look like G hat MN. So you can write all the equations of motion as quadratic in the generators. Let me use the same indices in the notes that will become available anyway. G and Q. And then this is graded symmetrized, which means it's symmetrized in the internal indices, it's anti-symmetrized in the space-time indices. So for example, P squared is in there. And then it turns out there's some extra, if you like, you can think of it as a normal ordering thing. So there's your equation of motion, and you have an awful lot of them because there's four free indices hanging around. So it might look like a lot, but if you restrict, for example, to the ordinary conformal case, the simplest equation of motion is when both of these are vital spinner indices, both of these are vital spinner indices, they're anti-symmetrized, you get P squared equals zero. But if you take P squared equals zero and just think of P as a generator of the conformal group and start doing conformal transformations, you get tons of equations. You get equations involving conformal boosts and all kinds of stuff. So if you want to do things in a manifestly superconformal form, you'd have an awful lot of equations. And because you have so many equations, there's a lot of reducibility. That means there's a lot of ghosts. The ghosts have even more indices. The next generation of ghosts has even more indices. It's a big, disgusting mess. So we looked at that a long time ago. But the general conclusion was it's a big, disgusting mess. It's the scientific term for it. Now, for super ADS, you have fewer generators. So I'll call these G. And we're not going to raise lower indices with the OSP metric. And this is just a piece of this. It's the usual thing. It's a graded anti-symmetrized part. All these curly indices look the same. But anyway, now certainly the OSP equations are just a subset of the superconformal equations. So, because if you like, you can start with your usual Klein-Gordon equation, and you have fewer symmetries to apply to it to get more equations. So, if you just look at these equations and you say, well, you only want G hat in this combination, then there's only a subset of those equations you can actually write. And so, the subset of those equations are. You have to make a trace, basically. That's the main point. And, well, in the case n equals 4, you don't have this normal ordering term. So here's the important point about OSP. The generators have two indices. The equations of motion have two indices, which mean the first generation ghosts have two indices. If you look at the reducibility conditions, those have two indices. Two indices, two indices, all the way down. So you get a very simple set, even though it's an infinite set of ghosts, it's a very simple set. They always have the same indices on them. And for n equals 4, it's even nicer because at each ghost level, the number of bosonic ghosts is equal to the number of fermionic ghosts. So the guess is then that when you start worrying about doing diagram calculations, worrying about zero modes, that you can just cancel out the bosonic and fermionic zero modes at each level and not have to worry about a lot of disgusting insertions to put in. That's the least principle. But at this level, at least you can see to write down the BRST operator is a lot easier because you don't have to deal with all these indices that are, just to write them on the blackboard is hard to invent a good notation to write it down. So let me be specific. What does the BRST operator look like?
So where did this equations of motion came from?
Okay, so the idea is this. You look at, okay, this is one of these technical details that I could go into, but I was thinking of leaving out, but let me just outline it. 10 minutes altogether? Okay, then that leaves, at least like half a minute for this question, but let me just give you the general idea. You want your equations to be quadratic in the generators. Higher order, you could, in principle, write though, you know, people like to do things with Casimirs. It's really disgusting to do things with Casimirs, though. Because your equation motions don't have to be invariant, they only have to be covariant. So you can get everything from stuff quadratic. Just look at, you just look at all the stuff you can write that's quadratic. You decompose in the different irreducible representations. And you can check very easily for the case of n equals 0 which ones can work and which ones don't work. And if you do that, you find that for the superconformal case, these are the ones that work. And for the ADS case, these are the ones that work.
Work meaning?
They give you the solution is what you want. The solution is the smallest representation of supersymmetry for that n. So you can explicitly solve them, but it's really easy because they only decompose into, let's see, well, in this superconformal case, there's only two pieces. You either symmetrize both indices or anti-symmetrize both indices. And the one that is the wrong thing, it gives you equations, like basically says that it has to be a constant. And then the other one is this. And in this case, it goes into four pieces. And so, again, you can pretty much see what it is from sticking in the case of n equals 0, and you can see these equations work. The other way to look at it is just to say, start out with the equation you know is n equals 0, which is like p squared equals 0, something like that. Just start doing transformations and see what other equations you get. That's the basic idea. Any other questions? Okay, so now the BRST operator comes out really simple. Well, you might not think it's really simple, but if you ever worked on these other ones, it would certainly look simple by comparison. So, I shouldn't use the same letters, but when I start using Hebrew letters, people get confused. So I've run out of alphabets. So now these are labeling the ghost level. In contrast, so my previous papers, you don't get this pyramid of ghosts, it's just a tower. It's just ghosts and another ghost the same kind, and just keeps sort of almost duplicating, except for some index structure I'll discuss in a minute. And this is a matrix notation with a super trace and all that jazz. I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. Cm plus n plus 1, bm, bn, where do the constraints come in? Well, b0 I've written as d, which are the covariant derivatives. So I switched to covariant derivatives as opposed to this thing where I wrote in terms of group generators because we're going to want to do a coset. To do the coset, you have to talk about that in terms of covariant derivatives because after all, this cosetting is just setting the corresponding covariant derivatives to be zero. But these equations work, you can just do it on the full group space and just forget about cosetting at all because it's just, you know, it's like this Wigner type analysis where you just, here's the group generators and what are your Casimirs, except like I said, I don't like Casimirs and that kind of thing. Now there's some extra terms involving structure constants, which I could write down but would be a waste of time because you're mostly interested in doing this contraction. And when you do this contraction, the only covariant derivatives left are the ones for W and those are abelian, so you don't get any structure constant terms. So this is about as simple as a BRST operator gets. And there's not much more you can say except if you've looked at our ghost pyramid paper, you can see, on the other hand, that's about as disgusting as a BRST operator can get. So there's a big contrast. Okay. So now let me get a little, let me just give the result for the symmetries of these different things, because even though they have two indices, the symmetries are a bit different level by level. And you can check this, it's very straightforward. So let me just give you, there's a little more details in the notes that'll be available online with this, with your photograph, your movies. So the symmetry of the ghosts, which is the same as the symmetries of the, so these are ghosts, these are anti-ghosts, except for the case of B0, because there is no C0 here, those are the covariant derivatives. Then Cn, it also applies to Bn, also applies for n equals 0, which is B0, has the symmetry that this is minus 1 to the n times n plus 1 over 2 times Cn transpose. Well, this, of course, again, is the graded transpose. So when you, that's a general statement, because you can apply this to the full group space, but when you apply this to the coset, then it breaks up a little bit differently. So then you have the even things have one index of each of the two kinds. Remember, the big index is broken up into two smaller ones, the two OSP things in the bottom. And then for the odd levels, you have C2n plus 1 AB and C2n plus 1 A prime B prime. Then they have the same index, and the symmetry is that C2n plus 1 is equal minus 1 to the n, C transpose 2n plus 1. But just to write it down, it's probably not so exciting. But the interesting thing is just the BRST operator is so simple. It never gets simpler than that, I don't think. In fact, it's simple, it's extra simple because the bosons and fermions, the x's and the thetas, have all the same structure. So it's just sort of like a supersizing of the bosonic case. Okay, so any questions on that stuff? So now I have like 5 more minutes, so let me discuss. I guess I could have started from the back of the talk and worked towards the front. It probably wouldn't have been any more confusing. But so this is the last question, which, so now I want to really discuss what the superspace looks like. So what I want to do is, well, the usual n equals 4 superspace is well known, and what the commutators and covariant derivatives are and stuff like that. So what I want to discuss now is this separation of the point is, when you write down the obvious commutators of the Yang-Mills supersymmetric covariant derivatives, it puts the stuff on shell. And the idea of using some subspace, like chiral or projective or stuff like that, is you have some kind of condition like projectiveness or chirality or whatever, and that's supposed to be the constraints, and then the other stuff is supposed to put it on shell. Because at least at the linearized level, if you just impose that something's projective, that doesn't imply equations of motion. Now, you want to check that that's true at the full non-abelian level. So let's look at that. So the relevant equations to look at are, so what are the projective constraints? So let me call those del u. These are the ones, these are the things in the denominator. These are the isotropy conditions. These are the things you want to mod out by. You want to say your superfields don't depend on the u and the u bar coordinates. They just depend on the w coordinates. So at least there's some superfield to satisfy that. So these covariant derivatives are, there's some internal derivatives, AB and A prime, B prime. So one of these is one of the OSPs, the other one's in the other one. Or maybe I should separate them out. And there's del A alpha. So those are the thetas that you don't want things to depend on. And there's also some Lorentz ones. I'll have a little bit more to say about that if people are interested, because I only have 3 minutes, maybe I won't. Then, so then you want to look at the algebra, and the point is, if you look at the algebra of this stuff, for the n equals 2 case, it just closes without any field strengths. But for the n equals 4 case, that's not true. So you have to do something a little bit tricky. So the n equals 4 case, the things that don't close look like this. Okay, so these things are anti-symmetric in the internal indices. So there's really just one term here, which I could have factored out the C or whatever. And then there's sort of a complex conjugate type of equation for del A prime alpha dot B beta. It looks pretty much the same thing. And then there's a phi bar A prime B prime. So the only thing that's causing would cause the trouble are these things. And so what you do is you just modify these constraints by adding these pieces to it. And now these things, phi AB, is that anti-symmetric matrix, CAB phi, whereas phi bar A prime B prime is CA prime B prime phi. These are actually the same phi. It's not, one is not the complex conjugate, they're the same one. Furthermore, this phi is itself projective. All these things acting on it vanish. So this phi is actually the projective field strength. So now what you do is you just modify your constraint. You just throw in, you just add in plus phi AB here, and you add in plus phi bar A prime B prime. And then the algebra of constraints closes, and nothing gets messed up, because you might say, oh, no, there's extra commutator terms, but these are projective by themselves, so that doesn't mess up. And phi with phi is going to give zero because it's just a single phi. So you can very easily, by this modification, have this interacting version of the covariant derivative constraints such that the algebra closes. But it was very important that there was only one of these fields that got added here. Because then if you had one field one place, another field another place, you get the commutator of two fields, that wouldn't be zero, that would mess stuff up. So we get the condition from that, that little n must be less than or equal to 2, and big N minus little n must be less than or equal to 2. That's the range of the indices. A and A prime, so if it's less or equal to 2, then at most it's anti-symmetric. There'll only be at most one of these things. So you can see, for example, if big N is 2, you could do the case little n is 0. That's chiral superspace, so that you can do. But for big N is equal to 4, you can see these two conditions together require that little n has to be exactly equal to big N over 2. So that's why you have to use projective superspace, and you can't use chiral superspace if you want to do N equals 4. And let me just squeeze in one last thing since I have negative 30 seconds left, which is an application, which is not really an application, it's a result which is known but which hasn't been derived from finishing up this program, which is let's look at what does in projective superspace notation, at least one way of writing, what is the four-point amplitude, n equals 4 Yang-Mills. So I'll just write down the one for the trees, but we know that the complicated part is the kinematic factor, because the rest of it is just some integral, like for just x stuff. So then, I'm writing it as a term in the effective action. This isn't going to make any difference. So there's integral over, it's four-point. So there's four x's for each of the four lines, so that's altogether 16 x's. But integrate only over 8 thetas, it's the same theta for each. Well, when I write things a little bit more explicitly, you'll see. So there's phi of x1, for example, and just the same theta. And then we evaluate it at the y is equal to 0. So then there's phi of x2, theta 0, same theta but different x. And then phi of x3, theta 0, phi of x4, theta 0. And then if you want, I'm doing an x space. I'll say a thing about momentum space in a minute, but for the tree graph, if you write an x space, it turns out the x-dependent stuff looks like this. So this is definitely not a manifestly superconformal form, but at least it's a pretty simple thing you can write down that includes all the different four-point amplitudes in n equals 4 Yang mils. This, in this case, the tree graph, but you change this factor, the x dependence for the other ones. And this, of course, is the full nonlinear field strength, so includes some contributions to the higher point functions. If you try to do the same thing for chiral superspace, well, you can write a linearized field strength, which is chiral, but it's the Yang-Mills field strength. So it has some extra spinner indices, it's higher dimension, you have to put some extra factors over here and stuff. You can write stuff in, so if you write it in super twisters, then what happens is your wave functions are basically always scalars in terms of, in super twister space. But if you want to write that for something that could, you could understand off-shell, or something, say, if you want to do a Fourier transform to write momentum space, then to turn that scalar super twister wave function into a super field is something you can only do in the projective case. In the, if you want to do it in the chiral case, then you have to throw in some extra twisters to turn that super field into a anti-symmetric tensor field strength. There's extra factors and stuff. But let me just say one thing about the twister thing. Is that, you know how these twister things look? They have these, all these kinds of things and those kinds of things, and you get this typical denominator, you know, that's 1, 2, 2, 3, stuff like that. And translating it directly into momentum space is not obvious because they're phases and things. Well, so what happens? So if you write it in, as an MHV amplitude in terms of, which corresponds to chiral superspace, it has these things. And if you write it in terms of anti-MHV, which is an anti-chiral superspace, and it has the complex conjugate ones, what does the twister thing look like if you write it in this projective space? Then these things get replaced essentially with the absolute value of either one. It's just 1 over ST in terms of the Mandelstam variables S and T. So if you want to write this in super twister space, it's very simple to write down, but it comes out in a form where you can automatically translate in momentum space, because everything is not written in terms of these twister invariants, it's written in terms of usual momentum invariants. And the factor I left, the only factor I left out is the conservation delta functions, which are for whatever your momenta are for whatever superspace you're working in. So at least for this four-point amplitude, which is the only one I've worked out, even the super twister expression looks simpler in that sense, in the sense that it's direct in terms of S and T, so it obviously translates. And that is directly related to this fact that when you translate it into superspace, the scalar wave functions of twister space directly turn into scalar superfields, because there is a scalar superfield that's projective, whereas there is no scalar superfield that's chiral for n equals 4 Yang mils. So I went 5 minutes over. But
the lowest component of phi is a real scalar of the six scalars of the game, or it's complex? It's like Z, or it's like Z plus Z bar?
It's complex, because there's this funny reality condition.
Okay, fine. So it's the lowest, it's the usual Z. So then I think
I don't know. I don't know what usual. The usual one is, it has some, when you write an SU4 notation.
It's the one that's lowest component is, the one with L minus J equals 0, whatever you want to say.
They're not six of those?
For five plus five prices. Five plus I.
So, oh, okay. All right. Yeah, okay.
But what was the choice of U1 made? At which stage?
Well, he chose the SU4, down to SU2, and SU2, and then the U1.
Ah, I see, okay.
And why isn't it symmetric in 1, 2, 3? Is it symmetric in 1, 2, 3, and 4?
Well, of course, these carry group indices. It's the usual.
Is there a nice identity that tells you that the choice of 1, 2, and 3, and 4?
Well, you mean, S and T can be written in different ways, you know, so. Let me do a moment.
Is it symmetric if I switch? So you have x squared?
Yeah. I mean, you can use a delta function to do it if you want.
Okay.
But it's essentially the same thing you're familiar with in momentum space. That S is 1 over P1 plus P2 squared is 1 over P3 plus P4 squared, and so on.
And this looks a lot like the thing that Howard and Sink was starting to do. I think that's related to Matthias' question.
Well, so they were doing things, I think they weren't doing things directly for Yang-Mills, they were doing things for supergravity, right? Or not? Let me say that better. They weren't doing things for, they were doing things for composite operators that were color singlets, right?
Yeah, so if X1 equal to X2, it would be like their object, right? So if you look at,
well, you know what happens if you do that. Things become terribly infrared divergent, and like it wasn't infrared divergent enough already. And so I've tried looking at those things, but they were always much more disgusting than the ordinary S-matrix amplitude. So I didn't see that was very enlightening. But certainly that was the kind of stuff they were looking at, yeah.
But the calculus should not be divergent, right? The
correlation function. No, just taking the trace doesn't do it. But if you want to put both of those at the same point, you're adding on external propagators, and then putting those at the same point. You're adding in an extra loop. So if you like to think of it that way, it's the tree is already becoming.
Correlation function. Physically, we know that those objects are perfectly finite. Correlation function of composite operator at different points should.
Yeah, phi and phi has no OPE, right? Because two Z's don't have any singularity when you put them together. It's a BPS state.
I don't know, I have to think about it. I think every loop would be infrared divergent. Well, you're putting two things at the same point. It's what happened to the usual infrared singularity?
It's 5-5 plus I-5-6, so it's 5-5 plus I-5-6.
So what's the Feynman diagram you're talking about? You're not doing the, even the free case, you take a free propagator and free-propagator them.
Sure, but separated points is different.
Oh, it's separated points, it's fine, yeah, of course. Yeah. But usually the composite operators people talk about, do they talk about ones which are regulated by separating the points?
No. The composite operator, you have a correlation function of several composite operator. Each composite operator is a different point from the other ones, that's what I mean. But the composite operators are, of course, phi to the n.
I guess, well, this one is a bad example, because n equals 4, there's no one, well, yeah, there's no one loop. But if you're doing something, you're taking this 4 point, I don't know. It's not hard to give a good example. They took a box diagram.
Yeah, it's a good example.
Is that okay? I'm going to do this one. I have to think. It's still just a propagator thing. Well, we have to do something more disgusting. You know, like this. Or no. Maybe it's a moot point, because all the... Because the loops in n equals 4 angles, the loop S matrices are infrared divergent anyway. So let me just say this. The simplest example you could possibly calculate that's non-zero, if you're restricting yourself to color singlet composite operators, has to be much more disgusting than this thing.
It is certainly finite. It should be finite. Both infrared and UV.
UV, I don't know about. Usually, you know, like energy momentum tensors, those tend to give you.
There's a number of dimensions, of course.
You can easily normalize those away. It's not a problem.
The UV, yeah, okay. Problem. Yeah, that's true. UV is going to be normalized in some way. Yeah, all right.
Now we start the new.